House Library and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:15 on March 25th. President Representative Ledoux, Representative Tilton, Representative Culver, Representative Jensen, Representative Tito, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business, and we've been joined by Representative Hughes, so we have a full house. Please turn off your cell phones. We have two bills on the agenda today. The first one is House Bill 114, Workers' Compensation Death Benefits. And to present the bill will be Representative Josephson and his staff, Jonathan Church.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the time.
Thank you for joining us today, and please state your name and affiliations for the record.
Okay. It's Andy Josephson. I represent District 17 in Anchorage.
Jonathan Church, staff to Representative Josephson.
Thank you.
Well, welcome, Jonathan. I believe this is the first time you've testified before the committee.
It is.
So, John, please continue.
Thank you. John will help me if there are questions about intestacy and Title 13 sort of probate things. I've taken those courses, but I think he's studied them more recently than I have. So today's bill is there are basically two facets to it. The first is about increasing the PPI to reflect an increase due to inflation that I think is appropriate. There's been no change in that since 2000. And so that's the first part. The second part is designed to offer a remedy for essentially the estates of workers who have been killed or otherwise died at the workplace. And that's sort of the larger part of the bill, although Section 2, which I just described on increasing the PPI whole body amount is certainly an important feature as well. So what I'll do is I'll move through the bill and I'll offer some commentary as I do that. Mr. Chairman, this bill, I think, is about a policy call. The most recent Supreme Court decision related to the section before us, which is basically 2330, is called Rani versus Whitewater Engineering. And I only looked at that to see sort of what the courts were doing there. It's sort of a simple decision. A Miss Rani, who was unmarried to her longtime live-in boyfriend, Gary Stone, argued that she should receive death benefits when Gary died. The Supreme Court unanimously ruled that she should not receive them. It held that the legislature had undertaken some line drawing, that's the word that Justice Brenner used, in the Workers' Compensation Code. It noted that legislatures frequently, when drafting bills, engage in line drawing. And I only mention that case because of the use of the term line drawing. It's my position that we need to redraw some of the lines. So this bill asks us to reconsider the redrawing of some of the lines, and here's the policy call before us. If a single childless person, and there are a lot of those in Alaska, dies at the workplace, and if there's no obvious third-party liability, and the way I perceive this, I wasn't a personal injury lawyer, but if someone falls off, God forbid, a perfectly good ladder and were to die, the remedy would be in Title 23. But if they were to fall off a ladder that had a bad rung due to some sort of malfunction or bad design, the estate might be able to sue the manufacturer of the ladder, I believe. But often in workplace deaths, that isn't the case. There's just either a generally unsafe working environment or perhaps employee negligence or some combination. So in these situations where someone dies and they're childless, Title 23 affords that person just a $10,000 funerary expense and nothing more. So literally, a person could die, they're a single individual, never married, no children, they would have their funeral expenses covered, and the employer, hopefully with some sorrow, would move on. Now, there could be some occupational safety violations and that sort of thing. But essentially, it's my view that there's no incentive in that circumstance to improve workplace safety. In the case that that led to my filing this bill. There was an OSHA investigation. There were some OSHA fines, and I think you'll hear about that from one testifier in a moment. So I'm concerned about the lack of a remedy for individuals like this. It occurs to me that many Americans, in a drive for personal freedom and a focus on their careers, have postponed marriage. And, of course, we have a high divorce rate. They also postpone having children. I think this is pretty obvious, and it doesn't need much documentation. We've all received bill concepts from well-intentioned Alaska citizens. Some become law, many do not. I think many bill concepts are impractical, perhaps too narrow, or pretty clearly something for which developing a consensus is impracticable. But some bill concepts have regulatory remedies or other solutions. I saw this one as having none of those problems. That is, sure, there could be a political consensus issue, but there would be no clear regulatory remedy, and this needed statutory reform. So again, to emphasize, in the circumstances where there's nothing that malfunctions at the workplace and nothing to target as being sort of tortuously manufactured, that is, a bad design, something exploded that shouldn't have exploded, there's no opportunity in Alaska to sue for wrongful death where those things are absent. So where it's just a pure workplace accident leading to someone's unfortunate death, there's no remedy other than the $10,000 funerary expense. So let me go through this section, the sectionals. Section 1 is uncodified. We would ask that this act be called the Abigail Cottle Act. She died in June 2011. I think her mother, I know her mother is here in the room today. It's my understanding that Abigail was working for an electric contractor at a Midtown Anchorage branch of Alaska USA. And I think, my understanding is she suffered an electric accident and fell and died as a result of those injuries. Section two is not directly related to the provisions or concepts I've just been introducing. This is the PPI rating, so this is fairly straightforward. It's been close to 15 years since the permanent partial impairment rating has been increased from a whole body figure of 177,000. You have a document that was included in your documents on basis and probably provided by Mr. Jackson. The permanent partial impairment rating, or PPI, if 177,000 was accurate in the year 2000, should properly be $255,584 now. And essentially the way this works is that a doctor could find that someone has suffered a partial permanent injury, and they really have scales for this, so that if a person lost a digit, that digit might be worth so many dollars. The reform here would be that this would reflect this new figure and they would have some increase in that. Section 3 provides a notice of death benefit. So it's very clear. So now we go back to the other purpose. It's very clear to the estate of the deceased person what their remedies are, that they can hire an attorney, that there is grief counseling, that it lays out some of the things the employer should provide so that the estate can know where to turn. So now we get into Section 4, which is arguably sort of the meat of the bill. Currently under law, as I said, funeral expenses are provided in basically all circumstances. If a person is a widow or widower under current law, or they have child or the deceased has child or children, then the survivors would receive 80% of the spendable weekly wages let me start over. In the circumstance where there are
a widow with no children,
the surviving spouse would receive 80% of the spendable weekly wage. There's a statute that describes what that is. It's quite complicated, and I'd use a lifeline for that and hope that someone from the administration is here. In the second circumstance, 50% of the spendable weekly wages for the widow or widower with one child. So if you have one child and a surviving spouse, essentially the two together would get 90% of the spendable weekly wage. In the third circumstance, if there was a surviving spouse and two or more children, together those surviving family members would get 100%. And the statutes sort of explain how that should be divided. Presumably, it could be someone could insist that mom gets this much and I get the rest, but you know, presumably no one's tracking that unless one wants to and wants to litigate it.
Representative Ledoux.
This is the current statute.
Okay. In the fourth circumstance, if there is an only child and no surviving spouse, that child would take 100% of the benefit. So the benefit, again, would be the spendable weekly wage. One concern, by the way, with the current law is the following. As I read the current law, a teenager may receive only a few months of financial assistance because under the current law, their support would end, I believe, at age 18 or 19. I'd have to confirm that. The bill would continue those payments for 5 years, and I think the age is 19. I think the definition in the statutes, which is in 2330, refers to age 19. So you could have a circumstance where a person loses their parent, their mother or father predeceased the person who died at work, or their whereabouts are unknown, that sort of circumstance, or they're divorced, I suppose. And that young adult child, could receive just the spendable weekly wage until they age out of the system, which I believe is age 19. So the point I'm trying to illustrate is the remedy in that circumstance. You've just learned that your mother or father died at work, and you could receive just a few months of payments. That's it. And plus the funeral expenses. I think there's a lack of generosity in the system, and that's clearly why I'm here. Then there's also a fifth scenario where if there are no surviving spouses but multiple children, as you might imagine, share and share alike, they would share 100% of the spendable weekly amount. All right, then we move into the next existing subsection. We'll get to the new parts now, but I'm doing this to sort of give you a sense of the current context. There is a provision now that says if a surviving spouse, no children, remarries, that 2 years after the remarriage, their coverage would stop. And it occurred to me as a former family law attorney that this is sort of consistent with some cases that say if a spouse receives alimony and remarries, upon application, the person paying that alimony could ask that it be suspended. And this is sort of, frankly, it's a little bit old school, right? This is sort of the idea that, I say old school because it reminds me of something you might read in the 50s in older statutes. Although the theory behind it clearly is you have a new means of support because you have a new spouse. Again, this is just to sort of run you through the current law. All right, the next scenario is also in current law, and then we'll move, and my bill would modify this a bit, and then I'll move into the entirely new section. Under current law, a person can prove up dependency even though they have no spouse and no children. So if a person, now obviously the person is deceased, so their estate would have to prove up the dependency. If a person dies at the workplace, and the person who died cared for an elderly mother or father, or a sibling, for example, they could receive a payment of up to $20,000, or it could be shared by those people that are dependent on the deceased. My bill says that $20,000 is inadequate. It suggests that it's inadequate, and that it should be increased to the whole body amount. Now, I will confess that that would be a part of the bill that I would be amenable, and of course the bill is now the committee's, but I would be amenable and supportive of some modification of. It's a generous change, so you would move from only $20,000 to as much as $177,000 under current law, or $255,000 if we increase the PPI, which my bill would do. Hopefully that's making sense.
Representative LeBeau.
So let me understand. Sure. Under current law, if the decedent is supporting mother, father, grandchildren, brothers and sisters, they could receive as much as $20,000?
That's correct. Now, actually,
can I?
Sure. That's a true
statement. So, but a child whom they're supporting, if they've reached over 18 years old and the person and the decedent is supporting their own child, would not get anything, but if they were supporting a grandchild, they would?
The answer appears to be yes. Now, it's actually, I think, as I said, 19. But subsection 4 of the bill does use the word grandchildren. That would be another, but you're correct. And so you could have this odd circumstance where a son, an 18-and-a-half-year-old son, gets 6 months of remuneration through the system, essentially. The grandchild could, if the grandchild was a dependent of the deceased grandfather, could receive more. Now, they're going to receive it, as would the son, by the way, in this hypothetical I've given, not as a lump sum, but as a percentage of the spendable weekly wage.
Under existing law. But only up through the share. But only up to 20 grand?
Yes. Total. Now, the theory, it doesn't seem very generous to me, but the theory is that the nuclear family is the nuclear family, right? It's this tight unit, and it gets less, I suppose, this isn't, I don't know, it gets less important when we're getting outside the ring of mom, dad, and children. I guess that's the theory. And, I mean, there's something to it, but it may not speak to a contemporary American family that I know.
And through the chair?
Follow.
I mean, actually, what I'm concerned about, and obviously it doesn't need to be taken care of in this bill, is that you can actually have a situation where the grandchildren, brothers or sisters, no matter how old they are, are receiving benefits, and the actual children, I mean, many people, support their kids through college, and that those children wouldn't be considered...
Right. Now, on that point, and it's a good sort of apropos moment for me, and I thank you for it, Representative Ledoux. This bill would allow for an extension. It's actually in Section 5. It would extend the death benefits payable to a child in the circumstance we were just talking about, which was Subsection 4 of page 3, to age 24. So those death benefits would not stop at 19. They would continue. It'd be a fraction of the spendable weekly allowance. And presumably it would get the child of the deceased, the decedent, through college, if that's what their druthers were. Now, the last scenario is the scenario which brings Ms. Burke to Juneau this morning. And what this does... This is a situation where no one is arguing that there are any dependents. That argument is not being made. Now, we all are emotionally dependent on one another. I hope we're aware of that. at least I hope we are at some level. But no one's arguing that someone's necessarily living in their household. So there's no widow, no widower, no child or children. And the deceased is fully single in all respects. So there's no need to prove up dependents because there is no dependents. This bill would propose that the estate would receive half of the whole body allowance. Under current law, it would be half of $177,000. That's $88,000. The reason you see in the fiscal note that shows several hundred thousand dollars and close to $500,000 is not because, frankly, of these sections, which I think are arguably the more controversial sections. It's because of the increase in the PPI, which is sort of a standalone issue, arguably, and Chairman Olson has his own bill relative to that. So bottom line is, if you want to treat money in 2000, the year 2000, as having a value that should reflect 2015, you've got to raise the PPI.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Yes.
The fiscal note's in thousands of dollars. So you're looking at $291,632,000 the first year, $583,265,000 in subsequent years. The impact is significant.
I want to ask about that. I don't understand.
Well, we will be. The person prepared the fiscal notes in the room.
I see that it's in thousands, but because I'm wondering, I'd like to ask certainly about that. I don't see how that figure gets derived. So essentially, the thinking in subsection 6, the new subsection 6, and then I'll wrap up, is that understandably, it's hard to say that the single person without dependents deserves more money, or the estate of the single person, than the person who did have dependents. And so, admittedly, this was sort of somewhat random, but it makes some sense to me that it should be, we used half the amount that would be available under the modified subsection 4, where the whole body allowance would be available, which is presently $177,000, it would be half of that. Finally, Section 5 would make it so that we no longer have to adjust the whole body rating. This would happen through statutorily or regulatorily through the Consumer Price Index. So that's essentially what this bill does. It's, I think the benefits of it are you'd see some increase in workplace safety. You couldn't ever quantify that very easily. But then again, I don't know how, we quantify it now. There's probably a way with our own tort structure where there's a lot of litigation, admittedly, but we have a reasonably safe country to operate in. It reflects the PPI increase, which there seems to be some bipartisan support for. And fundamentally, it says just because you're single and die doesn't mean your estate shouldn't be entitled to something. Because again, the estate can't sue in many circumstances in tort through wrongful death action. And so that's what this bill's about. And I'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
Who's got the first one? Representative Ledoux or? We got off light. You can move back up to the table if you'd like. We had not noticed this meeting for public testimony, but after we get done with the people who were involved in the fiscal note and the Division of Insurance, I'm going to invite the mother of the woman up. She came a long way from Anchorage, but it'll be after we get through the explanation of the bill itself. But that'll be the only testimony that we're going to be taking today. Let's start with Department of Risk Management. Who's here? Thanks, Ms. Davis. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Davis. I'm the risk manager for the Division of Risk Management.
And I guess my first question is the fiscal note would only apply to state employees. It would not apply to the impact on the private sector workers' compensation
Yes, Mr.
policies.
Chairman. The fiscal note is based on our AWCB data for the last 9 years. The last 5 years, going back to 2009, I just took the PPI payout. I averaged that. We times it by 44,000. I then looked at our claim history to see if we had had any similar circumstances that would affect the state, and I found only one deceased person who died in the line of duty who had no family or no dependents that I could find in the claim record. So I took the amount payout for that circumstance and averaged it, the cost out over 5 years.
You might not be the right person, but you can probably point me in the right direction. I've got a feeling you probably know the rest of the people or a number of the people in the room, but typically, wouldn't the private sector probably have more fatalities than the
certain
state?
Industries? The state's been very fortunate. We have had fatalities. I'm sure we're all aware of those. We've seen in the paper, but for the most part, it's for our more high-risk occupations, such as public safety, those individuals who fly as part of their job.
Any questions? Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, so I'm still trying to figure out this fiscal note. Is this saying that this would cost the state $291 million?
No. Through the chair, I have to extend an apology. I listed the actual whole numbers in my estimates. So I estimated for a half year $291,632, and the first full year after implementation, $583,265. It's a failure on my part for the form, and I apologize.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Kito.
Thank you. Ms. Davison, looking at the analysis on the fiscal note, there's a discussion, I think it's the fourth paragraph down, and it talks about the bill could result in a yearly average annual increase of $23,585, and it seems like this is the one that is the costly section, and it looks as though in the last 5 years we've only had one case that this would apply to. So I guess I'm wondering where the $291,000 and the $500,000 costs are coming from.
Okay. Well, I guess you call it the back of the envelope math. I took out our average annual PPI payout over 5 years. I times that by the increase of the percentage, 44%. I then looked in to see what would happen to our 6% second injury fund amount, added that. And then I looked back at our records and found that only one individual had passed due to an on-the-job fatality that would result, they had no dependents. So rather than getting $20,000 in a payout that would increase it, and I took that increase and averaged it out over 5 years.
So I guess I'm trying to get clear. Does that mean I think that most of the costs are as a result of the CPI increase?
I didn't make any accounting for the CPI because my understanding is we're entering a deflationary period. I didn't, and that's an unknown in the future. The bulk of the costs are due to the actual PPI rate increase itself, because we see a large number of partial permanent impairment ratings for state employees.
The historic catch-up. Okay, thanks.
President Goldberg.
Mr. Chairman, so the state apparently is self-insured for workers' comp, right?
Through the chair, yes, sir, that's
okay.
Correct.
So isn't there any kind of reinsurance or umbrella policy to for these kinds of claims, excessive claims?
No, sir, there is not. We are completely self-insured.
No other for large awards or, okay.
No, sir.
Well, I'm not an insurance guy, but most of the government stuff that I've worked on, we've had another level. We're self-insured to a certain point, and then we have reinsurance or we have other policies that kick in.
That would be a liability. Workers' comp is an exclusive remedy.
And you're the expert in workers' comp.
Well, no, so there's some experts in the room. I think one of them.
Well, I guess I would look for a way to reduce our exposure if there is, as just a conversation piece. But thank you for that answer.
Thanks again. Larry Wang-Heyer. Thank you for joining us again today, and I think you're going to be up again in a little while.
Yes, sir.
Different bill, but please state your name and affiliation for the record.
For the record, my name is Lori Wing-Heyer. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska.
Any comments or just questions?
Certainly we'll take questions. I mean, the bill will have somewhat of an impact, we are told, by the National Council on Compensation Insurance, which is a statistical rating organization that sets the rates for the state of Alaska. They are estimating that when the bill, if it is adopted, would possibly have an impact on rates of 4% overall, based on historical. If I could make a comment to through the chair to Representative Culver, often self-insureds will have a stop loss or an excess liability, excess workers' compensation policy. I'm sure you're remembering Matt Sue and others. Excess of $500,000 or $1 million, that is common on large employers. That is very correct, sir. Larger employers often do not, because there's often a pretty high cost to do that. And if you don't, we call it the burn layer. If you don't exceed that very often, it's often better to just save that money and use it for the claims expenses rather than put it into the policy itself. And I believe that's what the state has determined it's in its best interest to do.
Thank you.
So the bulk of the claims, if this was law, would fall under the private policyholders rather than the state, just by the sheer numbers of people in the workers in the private sector?
Most large employers have small claims, and I'm saying small, $20,000 to $100,000, and occasionally you'll get that pop that's a large claim.
So having frequency versus
exactly.
Scary.
You'll have a significant injury, or in this case that we're discussing today, a fatality, and it's a large dollar.
Well, statistically, Madam Director, what's our average or fatality rate? If you said you imputed that this would result in a 4% increase to workers' compensation costs to the private sector. Do we have like a rating? Is there an average number of annual fatalities in the Alaskan workplace?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, there is, but I don't have that. I would bet that the director of workers' compensation does.
Okay.
And he's in the audience, so I would believe that Director Monocle has that for you.
Thank you.
Any further questions for the director? Thanks again.
Thank you.
Mr. Monocle, you're hiding in the back row again. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us.
For the record, my name is Mike Monocle. I'm the director for the Division of Workers' Compensation for the state of Alaska. And I'm here to answer questions. I just would start with a discussion about what constitutes a child or dependable qualifying child. It is a child up to the age of 19. They can add 4 more years if they are attending college for the first 4 years of college. But also under the definition of child, it does say that if the child, let me just read this here. Unless the child is wholly dependent upon the deceased employee. So it can continue beyond the age of 19 plus the 4 years if the child is dependent. So it's not just grandchildren or grandparents or parents. If a dependent child could continue to receive those benefits beyond the age of 19.
Representative Ledoux.
So would that in... Let's say the child were in high school, when the sophomore in high school, when the decedent died, and he hits 19 years old, and by the time he's 19 years old, he's enrolled in college and he's decided that he wants to do either a PhD or a medical school program, which his father or mother would have been paying for. Will the workers' compensation cover that? Would that be considered wholly dependent?
Through the chair, I don't believe so. It says the first 4 years of college, so it doesn't anticipate paying for graduate school. And it does say that the person over 19 years old is wholly dependent upon the deceased employee and incapable of self-support by reason of mental or physical disability.
Thank you.
Can I, just for my own record,
certainly,
ask the director to
refer
your reading, which statute?
Through the chair, it's under the definition part of the statute, 2330.395, number 7.
Representative Keto. Nope. Representative Hughes.
Thank you. I feel like I need a little more foundation. I'm not as familiar with worker comp as the chair is. And so, and whether you're, I figure because you're working with this day in, day out, you might know, but I'm thinking of the private sector. We're talking about raising those rates by 4%, which we've heard that ours are very high, and it's tough anyway, so kind of cringe at that thought. But I was wondering, I'm thinking about the family, I'm thinking about when this very unfortunate kind of situation happens. What we're talking about as far as this would be somewhat of an, it would be an automatic payment that's it's defined in statute, but the family is often filing lawsuits and things like that and recouping in other ways against the employer. Are they not? Or are they not?
Yeah. Through the chair, it depends. I think workers' comp is an exclusive liability. In fact, you cannot bring a separate action against the employer, even if they are negligent. However, I think as Representative Josephson said, if there's a third-party exposure, if the rung of the ladder was defective, or you're working with a piece of machinery that's defective, you're not that exclusive liability does not extend to that third party. So you could bring a suit against that third party for some type of a defect in machinery, though the workers' comp law does provide for an offset. So you would not get the full death benefit and a third-party recovery. The employer would be allowed to reduce their benefit payments by that third-party recovery.
Okay, thank you.
And that,
Representative Josephson?
Thank you. That's called the secondary injury fund, or the second injury fund, right?
Through the chair, no. There is simply just a separate provision in law that allows the employer to offset by third-party recovery. The second injury fund is a fund that's established through assessments against employers' indemnity benefits, and where the second injury fund comes into play is if you hire somebody or retain somebody that has a qualifying pre-existing condition, and then they have a subsequent workplace injury that's made worse because of that pre-existing condition. So you hire me knowing that I've had a lot of back issues, and subsequently I get injured, I hurt my back, the fund could step in and reimburse the employer for those indemnity benefit payments if they meet all the requirements of that second injury fund reimbursement.
Any further questions? Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
You can be around for the second half?
Yes.
Ms. Mary Ann Burke, would you please join us? And on behalf of the committee, please accept our condolences for your loss. And I know it's been a very trying time for you, but please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you.
Mary Ann Burke. An affiliation? What kind?
You've got our undivided attention for...
Okay. Distinguished representatives and colleagues and chair, thank you so much for letting me speak before you. You have no idea what I've gone through to this point. This is bittersweet to talk to you. I'm excited, but I am sad for the reason I stand before you. My daughter was killed in the workplace, and no value at all, zero, was given for her life. And when you talk about different money and stuff in the workplace environment, there was nothing given for her life but the funeral costs. That's it, because she had no dependents. And there was no liability to the employer. Nothing happened to the employer whatsoever because it's no fault insurance. Nothing happens. If there is any payout, the insurance pays it, and I'll get to that in a minute. But I just want to emphasize those 2 points before I start. My daughter was the second child of 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls. Her sister and her would play dolls growing up. She enjoyed soccer, basketball, babysitting, daycare. She went to Home Depot. She volunteered at Change Point Church doing lighting for all of their services for 3 years. She helped with the youth group at Change Point. This is her as a 14-year-old. This is all the kids when we got to Alaska. We went to that those rocks, you know, when you first get into Alaska. She was a new apprentice with Raven Electric, so she was not with the unions. The private sector is not as up as the unions are sometimes. She was in Whitney, we moved on my wire. They were working on an open junction box and bank remodel job, taking down lights. The gentleman did not turn off the circuit breaker or lock and tag as he was supposed to. This was because he wasn't planning on doing that lighting that night. Usually he would bring temporary lights, but he wasn't planning on doing that work that night. So they used the lights that were there and they just turned off light switches. Abigail had an inadequate non-contact tester. It did not clamp onto the wire. It just went near the wire, so it did not sense the live wire. She tried it twice. It showed green for safe or to go. And she touched the live wire and got locked up. Her co-workers tried to get her off the ladder. They couldn't. They finally kicked the ladder real hard, and she fell off to the floor. She went into seizures. I was told there was about 440 volts that went through her body. They used a defibrillator, and she's in the hospital. She was 26 years old, and she died on June 21st, 2011. I cannot tell you how much we miss Abigail. And for the world, everything that with us. Her sister does not have a sister anymore. Her brothers do not have a sister that they had anymore to talk with and to be support with. Thank you. After about 3 months after her death, I started pursuing justice. I called many lawyers and no one would represent me. I didn't understand. They said that, well, we represented the oil companies 2 weeks ago, so if we represent you, we'd be on the other side. And I found out that they would get nothing going through workers' comp because there was no room for them. That there were similar cases to mine, and they got to the Illinois Supreme Court, and there was nothing, there was no win. So they didn't want to represent me, even pro bono. So I have been fighting this case all by myself since 2 years after her death, so a year and a half, with nothing happening yet. I'm at the appellate court with workers' comp, and everyone just acts like this is for nothing, but I'm still fighting for her life. I couldn't sue the employer through civil court because of HB 323 that was passed in 2004. So a work-related death, because it was in the workplace, I couldn't go through civil court, so I couldn't get any type of justice. Bill 303 would have reversed the wrongful death going into civil court, and it would have allowed it to go back in civil court, but that was stopped. And I understood it was stopped mostly by business interests. Workers' comp means zero value to people like my daughter who have no dependents, except for the funeral costs, which to me is just the employer claiming that they're mess. The employer was citing 5 citations by OSHA, 4 of which contributed to my daughter's death. So it was definitely gross negligence. And yet they paid only $11,000 to OSHA. And OSHA told me in 3 years their slate would be wiped clean. They could do the same thing in 3 years. This is just crazy. I just couldn't believe all this. I had to find all this out myself, all by myself. So as Andy said, the Abigail Carter Act would update the value of life to approximately $257, I think it is, for this year. It's 15 years old being updated. So all those people that lose their arm and are injured, they're getting a smaller piece of the pie right now. But if it's updated, they'll get a better part of the pie for today's wages, today's costs. The victims of families that aren't like Abigail, there's no dependents, at least there'd be something for their life. There was nothing. It's just such a hollow feeling that there's nothing at all for her life. The changes also need to be that the statute of limitation needs to be raised. It was only 1 year with workers' comp, but I got in my exception for 2 years. But it needs to be raised to at least 4 years. And from California, and California has 4 year statute of limitation on wrongful death. This is not really wrongful death anymore because it's in workers' comp. But it needs to be to 4 years because when you're a parent and you're grieving, 2 years is just goes by like that. When you're dealing with their stuff and you're sitting in their estate and you're trying to figure out what's going on legally, 1 year is not enough. And that's what workers' comp currently has. am a Republican, but thankfully a Democrat, Hannah Josephson, stepped up to the plate to help me. So this is a bipartisan thing. So, you know, I hear, oh, this is Republican, this is Democrat, well, they're going to pass this and they're not going to pass that. This is bipartisan. This is our children. This is our families. These are our lives. These are the people around us without lives. This is bipartisan. So I'm hoping we, being a very powerful part of the legislature, can pass this. And maybe there needs to be some work on it. As far as the cost to businesses, I know businesses don't want to pay more for workers' comp. They could have a life insurance policy on each employee. They could do that. That's not that much. Even require an employee to have a life insurance policy if they're really, you know, going to put it at a minimum. But that's also what can happen. So that at least in every situation, somebody has value. But the more important thing, legislatures, is please understand, if I'm an employer and there's a $50,000 piece of equipment that I should buy for my company, but there's no possible lawsuit for me to get in trouble, why would I buy that if I don't have to? See, that's the problem. There's no need for them to be safe with no-fault insurance. That's the problem with workers' comp right now. I know it's nationwide, but that's the problem that's going on that I'm trying to hopefully change. Thank you so much for listening to me. Sorry for my tears. I couldn't help it.
Before I open it up to the committee for questions, there's a reason for the exclusive remedy, and that's because it will pay immediately. Whether or not there's a perception, oftentimes, not oftentimes, but sometimes claims may not be legitimate. Obviously, that was not the case in this one.
Right.
Workers' comp will pay immediately, and then if there's issues and grounds, there's a extremely lengthy process to go through for an insurance company to deny coverages, but typically they pay coverage from the time of loss until, I don't know, I could probably ask somebody the number of claims that are controverted, but I don't think it's that many, but it has to be like that so that people can get immediate treatment.
Right. Mr. Chair, what I was told from Carol at Workers' Comp, she was the only one who's really able to help me because, like I said, I couldn't get any legal help on this hardly at all. She said that when it's death in the workplace, it should cease to be workers' comp. That's the problem, is that death should be taken out of workers' comp so that if there's negligence, as he was in Abigail's case, they didn't lock and tag, they didn't communicate, there's a whole bunch of things they didn't do that caused Abigail's death. She was a new apprentice, brand new, trusting her journeyman that she was safe, and she was in a very unsafe environment. And they weren't even in the room. That's another problem. But that's not an OSHA thing. But that's where death should not be in the workplace, so that there can be justice with the employers. And they carry insurance, and they carry blanket insurances, you know. They can be covered.
Any questions for Ms. Burke? Thank you again for making
thank
the
you so very much
fight out today. And with that, we're going to hold the bill over and move on to the second brief after a brief at ease. Next item on the calendar is House Bill 164. To present the bill is not Michaela Fowler. It's Conrad Jackson of my office. We also have Lori Wanghire, who will be bringing up shortly. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. I'm just turning the computer on, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
Would you be out of order to comment on that last bill at all?
Yeah, because we're on to the new one.
All right.
We got something doesn't smell right there on that
we're
situation.
Yeah. But, Conrad. Back on the record. Or are we off the record?
No.
We're on the record.
Brief at ease.
We're waiting on Conrad.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record. I think we have Director Wanghire present the bill. Welcome back.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lori Wanghire. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. Before you, you should have a PowerPoint that we put together, which hopefully is summarizing the bill, and we can talk about it a bill that is a page and a half title, an act relating to insurance. And I want to thank the chairman and the committee for making time in your schedule today to talk to us about our bill.
On that point, we had a bill, I believe, 4 or 5 years ago with the same number that had a three-page title, as I recall.
And I'm hoping that's not a sign of any sort, sir. But
it was also 80 pages.
It passed, yeah. Unanimous.
Please continue.
The mission of the division, as you all know, and I think it's important to state this again, is to protect consumers, regulate the insurance industry to protect consumers. And I know when we've done other presentations before this committee, we've talked about it. And unlike any other major industry, the individual state governments are the primary regulators of this business of insurance. In Alaska, we have 7 domestic insurance companies, and we regulate close to 1,100 foreign insurance companies. So you all know the 7 domestics, or you've probably heard of them, the Alaska Nationals, there's Alaska Vision, Sunderland, and others, Timber Exchange, that are domiciled here.
Lori, can I come in for 1 minute?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
By foreign insurer, that doesn't necessarily mean outside the country. It means outside the state of Alaska.
Yes. Most of it, you know, on every day. From State Farm to Safeco to Geico to Primera to Aetna, those would all qualify that they're not domiciled. It doesn't mean that they're a bad insurer. It's just the way that they're incorporated, that they're not domiciled in the state of Alaska. And the ones we're talking about today, right now, in particular, are those that are domiciled within the state of Alaska. In 1945, Congress passed the McCarran-Ferguson Act, and in doing so, they gave the states the authority to regulate insurance. And to this date, insurance has been regulated by state. And the reason it is because state-based regulation works. It has been tested time and time again. In the act, Congress said that no act of Congress shall be construed to invalidate, impair, or supersede any law by any state for the purpose of regulating the business of insurance. But in 2010, Congress passed Dodd-Frank. And in Dodd-Frank, there is a provision known as the Federal Insurance Office. And while it is set up right now as a non-regulatory agency, it is poised at any time to step in and take over state-based regulation. And it's not that we fight it every day, but we are very much aware of its existence. And we are very much aware of the power or the authority that it could hold over the states in coming in to have federal regulation of insurance, where state-based regulation has been very successful for over 100 years. In the 2007-2009 financial crisis, state-based regulation or insurance industry was looked at very hard, as were other financial industries. And insurance came out as a shining example of what worked. The independent insurance agents, of which we do have a local chapter, I'm sure many of you have heard of the Alaska Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers, came out and said, even during the most tumultuous of times, state insurance regulators ensure that insurers are insolvent, that claims are paid, and that consumers are protected. The IIBA remains dedicated to preserving state-based insurance regulators. This statement was powerful enough that the Government Accountability Office, we kept that in their report that they gave to Congress on the financial service industry when the financial crisis had its meltdown in 2007 and 2009. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, as the commissioner alluded to, is the standard-setting regulatory support organization created and governed by the 56 jurisdictions, 50 states, the District of Columbia, and the 5 territories of the United States. Through the NAIC, the state insurance regulators establish the best practices, the procedures, and the protocols of the insurance companies, the producers, the brokers, and the adjusters. Through peer review, we monitor companies, insurance companies, brokers, and ourselves. While much of the business of insurance is local in nature due to the demographics, the local exposures, such as earthquakes in Alaska, which other states may not have an exposure to, the elected or appointed state regulators recognize that there is often a need for continuity or national standards of uniformity. The NAIC, working with the regulators, promote uniformity, reciprocity, and consistency at the national level through the development of model laws and regulation. Much of the work done at the NAIC is through committees, task force, and working groups. Alaska sits on two of the letter committees, Property and Casualty, Market Regulation and Consumer Affairs, the C and D committee. We sit on 14 task forces, three liaison committees, including the American Indian and Alaska Native Liaison Committee, which I'm the vice chair of, and numerous working groups. Here's where the discussions begin on what should be considered for model laws. From there, the NAIC dedicates significant resources to educating consumers and the industry for support of what a model law may be and the adoption by membership. Model laws are developed by drafting procedures, a rigorous process providing notice, an opportunity for consumer groups and industries to comment. They take years to develop to the point that they're being presented to groups such as labor and commerce. Both the parent committee, such as property and casualty, finance, health, whatever the parent committee would be, and the entire membership of NAIC must adopt the proposed model law before it comes back to the state. And the state, in most cases, is not required to adopt the model law, except in the circumstance that brings us here today. The adoption of the NAIC financial regulation standards and accreditation program. The Financial Regulation Standards and Accreditation Program is to establish and maintain state regulatory standards to promote sound insurance company financial solvency regulation. It seems simple, but as I told you earlier, we have 7 domestic and 1,100 foreign insurers that we monitor. And I'm on slide seven, and I should have said something. I'm looking at the slides, and I can't see that you are looking at two, and I apologize that your backs are to them, so my apologies to the committee. But so we're a rather small department, and with that many insurers, we need to be able to rely on our counterparts in other states, that the insurance companies that are coming up here to sell insurance to Alaskan consumers are meeting a certain standard of financial solvency. Likewise, insurance companies doing business domiciled in Alaska that are going outside to sell insurance, other insurance commissioners or directors need to trust that those insurance companies are also financially solvent. Last but equally important, if not more important, is that we need to be able to guarantee that our consumers, your constituents, that those companies are financially solid, that when the claims are sent in, when they are submitted, that the funds are there to pay those claims. This program is what accreditation is about, is that the money will be there for the companies to pay the claims when submitted. Slide 8. The accreditation program provides a process whereby solvency regulations of multi-state insurance companies can be enhanced and adequately monitored. As we talked about, this is very important for a small state. Our domestic companies, those that are domiciled here, and those that come into Alaska to do business. In Alaska, consumers could be negatively impacted as companies may decide not to operate in Alaska. There could, and this is true, that companies could decide not to operate if a state could not accept our financial examinations, if we lost our accreditation and they had to bear the expense of having every state conduct an examination through their financial records and could not accept theirs, that would be an additional burden to them, and they may elect to not do business in Alaska or be domiciled here, which would be a reduction, one, in the number of insurers here, and we have had numerous conversations about the lack of number of insurers here, and it would be a reduction in employment, and it could be a reduction in the premium tax that is paid into the state.
On that note, what do you generate a year in income division?
Mr. Chairman, about $55 million and about $7 million in fees that we collect for from producers and the insurance companies.
So low sex fees. What's your budget?
Right now?
Mm-hmm. Oh, last year.
Last year it was about $7.5 million. It's been reduced some.
So you're a, I hesitate to use the word cash cow, but you bring in more money than we spend on you.
That is correct, sir. We are receipt supported through the fees that we collect from the insurance companies, the insurance, and our licensing.
And that's one of the reasons this bill is important.
This bill is important, yes, sir.
Yeah.
The accreditation is for a five-year period, and one of the key components of the financial solvency is that when the NAIC comes in, they will review. It's a peer review, and it can have a consultant on it. They will review for our solvency laws and our regulations to see that we are current. We are due for an interim audit or an interim exam in June of 2015, and it pains me greatly to say that when they come in or when we fill out the paperwork for June of 2015, we will not pass. That is why we are meeting here today. I have no reason to try and hide anything from this committee or from the governor or from the legislature, but for whatever reason, I have no excuse. I'm on slide 10, but there are three parts of this bill that should have been passed two or three years ago and weren't. I don't know why. I wish I could tell you. I have no reason. But they were not proposed, and I have no excuse. This HB 164, this risk-based capital, which on page 10, at part of the bill, it's pages 2 through 8. It is, as far as statute, it's 2114, risk-based capital. What it is doing is changing the minimum amount of capital appropriate for the insurer. This all has to do with solvency of insurers, this entire bill. This should have been effective January 1st of 2015. I am submitting the bill to you today. That's how far behind I am. Another part of this bill should have been submitted or been effective January 1st, 2014. Another part of the bill needs to be effective January 1st, 2016.
Representative Ledoux.
So do I understand correctly that in order to be accredited, we've got to pass this legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes, ma'am.
And if we're not accredited, all sorts of problems happen.
Through the chair, yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
That's why it was fast track.
Summarizing the bill, and the risk-based capital portion is the capital is the cushion to protect the solvency. It's looking at what the company has out as far as risk, and it's a ratio of their risk for their capital and making it so that we know that there is enough capital against the risk that the company has for their underwriting, for other investments they may have made, again, to make sure that there's enough money within the company to pay for the claims when the consumers of Alaska submit those claims. Page 11, this is the insurance holding company. This is Chapter 22, the insurance holding company, part of Title 21. It's page 8 through 16 of the bill. Of your sectional analysis, it's page 4 through 12. This is to be effective 2016 for us to pass accreditation. This model is fairly simple. If you go back to the financial crisis, you probably heard a lot of AIG, and AIG was a holding company. And what brought down AIG was not the insurance operations. It's the aircraft leasing and other investments that AIG had. This allows us to look at those other operations and for them not to be putting the insurance dollars into the other operations. It's that, I mean, there's a lot of words on this page, but that's in essence what this is going to do. It does require some other reporting mechanisms of the insurance companies, but in essence, that's what the holding company provisions of this bill does.
It was also substandard mortgages, wasn't it?
It was substandard mortgage, sir. Yes, correct. You're correct. Mm-hmm. Page 12, this is new to chapter or Title 21. Risk management and own risk solvency assessment. This is a enterprise risk management. It's requiring the insurance companies, it's a confidential filing, asking them to report to us themselves on what their investments are, their risk management framework, so that we can see on an annual basis how they are judging themselves. It's an enterprise risk management. I know that's a term that's been bandied about for the last few years, but it's a new requirement. It has not become a model law of NAIC yet. It has been proposed. We expect that it will be adopted this fall, so we have included it in the bill. The last one is the ORSA. It's the controlling insurance producers, and this one was to be effective January 1st, 2014, and this is basically for when an insurance producer owns the insurance company itself, and it's putting some requirements back between the two of when you own the company and are the insurance producer all in one. And it's additional guidelines for business between the controlled insurers and controlled producers necessary for fiduciary and oversight reasons. And I know I went through that pretty quick, but I'm happy to go through the bill. It is 30-some pages, but that, in essence, is why we had asked for the bill to be put before you today, is because, as you can see, there are three parts of this bill that I'm between a rock and a hard place. It needs to go through this year because the one part that needs to be effective January 1st, 2016, I don't have another chance to get it through. And there's a part that should have been in 15 and a part that should have been in 14.
Just for the record, how long have you been director? Year and a half? Year?
It was a year in February, sir, through the chair.
Representative Ledoux.
In Section 1, it changes from life and health insurer, property, casualty, everything to just domestic insurer. Are maritime policies, indemnity policies, are they included in this now?
If they were a domestic company, but generally speaking, maritime is going to be a surplus lines company, or a surplus lines placement.
And so surplus...
Maritime is generally, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, maritime companies are generally a Lloyd's of London. They wouldn't be a domestic company. There may be some written through Alaska, a domestic, and then they would be included in this.
On that note, I don't believe we've had a domestic insurer that wrote maritime coverages for at least 15 years.
What about, through the chair, what about Alaska National?
No, I think the last one was Pacific Marine.
Yeah, they may write some incidental, but through the chair, I'm not... It's not their main line of business, through the chair.
To the best of my knowledge, Alaska National writes some incidental longshoremen and harbor workers coverage, but that would be the... they're not doing anything offshore unless it's people on the platforms. The L&H coverage on workers' comp policies for people on the platforms.
Through the chair, Sunderland may write some.
I stand corrected. Representative Hughes.
Yeah, thank you, Laura. I'm sure glad you're doing what you're doing, and it's not me. I'm just wondering, when you talk about the ones that are domiciled here in Alaska, how much business do they do outside? Because I understand the importance of the accreditation so that they don't have to go through being checked out by every state. But just curious how much they're doing outside of Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, probably the one that is doing the most outside of, and if not the only one that's doing anything outside, would be Alaska National, and they're operating a little bit in Idaho, California, Louisiana, and probably looking to expand a little. But our other domestics are primarily, Sunderland is doing some outside. I'm trying to, but the others are pretty content doing Alaska Timber Exchange and such. They're content to be in Alaska.
Okay, thank you. And actually, it's a new question, Mr. Chair.
New question.
But okay. Just, it's obvious that, that this is needed to be taken care of and sooner rather than later, and some should have been even before now. The question, when you have a bill like this that has to get through, is there anything in these 30 pages or how many ever pages there are that are not related and not needed for the accreditation, but you put it in here because it's something that is needed and would be helpful?
Through the chair, no, that we limit this strictly to accreditation.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Culver, I knew somebody had a question.
Well, Madam Director, if you could just assure me that Obamacare's not stuffed in here somewhere.
Well, if it's not, I'm not.
Through the chair, Representative Culver, this is strictly accreditation financial solvency of the domestic insurance companies in Alaska.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Certainly.
Will we receive graduate degrees in insurance after completing this bill?
The only person in the room that has one of those, I believe, is the director.
Okay. We're getting up to speed rather quickly.
There might be two. I'm not sure, but certainly not me. Any further questions?
Thank you for your time. Sincerely appreciate you making time today.
We have Marty Hester in the room, Deputy Director, for questions only. With that, I may just open it up to anybody got any questions for Marty? I'll bring them up. You got off easy. Seeing that, I will open it up to public testimony if nobody has any further questions. Is there anybody signed up? Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none and hearing none, I'm going to close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee. What are the wishes of the committee?
Am I supposed to be
moving? Any questions? What are the wishes of the committee?
All right. Okay. I didn't realize, Mr. Chair, that we were going to move it today, but after that presentation, understanding that we're behind the eight ball in some respects and others, the deadlines are coming up, I move House Bill Number 164, 29-LS0778/A from committee with attached fiscal notes and what's the other thing?
Seeing no opposition and hearing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee with attached fiscal notes, individual recommendations, and with that, we will adjourn at 4:35.